and insisted that things ain't what they used to be. Well, that's true, but not in the way they mean it. Most things used to be worse, not better. But it is extremely easy for humans to forget how things really did used to be. In Western Europe and North America, only the very oldest who have lived through the Second World War or the Great Depression have any personal recollection of the severe deprivation and hunger of just a few decades ago. Yet even in China and India, where extreme poverty was the reality for the vast majority just a couple of generations ago, it is now mostly forgotten by people who live in decent houses, have clean clothes, and ride mopeds. The Swedish author and journalist Lasse Berg wrote an excellent report from rural India in the 1970s. When he returned 25 years later, he could see clearly how living conditions had improved. Pictures from his visit in the 1970s showed earthen floors, clay walls, half-naked children, and the eyes of villagers with low self-esteem and little knowledge of the outside world. They were a stark contrast to the concrete houses of the late 1990s, where well-dressed children played and self-confident and curious villagers watched TV. When Lasse showed the villagers the 1970s pictures, they couldn't believe the photos were taken in their neighborhood. "No," they said, "this can't be here. You must be mistaken. We have never been that poor." Like most people, they were living in the moment, busy with new problems, like the children watching immoral soap operas or not having enough money to buy a motorbike. Beyond living memory, for some reason we avoid reminding ourselves and our children about the miseries and brutalities of the past. The truth is to be found in ancient graveyards and burial sites, where archaeologists have to get used to discovering that a large proportion of all the remains they dig up are those of children. Most will have been killed by starvation or disgusting diseases. But many child skeletons bear the marks of physical violence. Hunter-gatherer societies often had murder rates above 10%, and children were not spared. In today's graveyards, child graves are rare. Selective reporting. We are subjected to never-ending cascades of negative news from across the world. Wars, famines, natural disasters, political mistakes, corruption, budget cuts, diseases, mass layoffs, acts of terror. Journalists who reported flights that didn't crash or crops that didn't fail would quickly lose their jobs. Stories about gradual improvements rarely make the front page, even when they occur on a dramatic scale and impact millions of people. And thanks to increasing press freedom and improving technology, we hear more about more disasters than ever before. When Europeans slaughtered indigenous peoples across America a few centuries ago, it didn't make the news back in the old world. When central planning resulted in mass famine in rural China, millions starved to death, while the youngsters in Europe waving communist red flags knew nothing about it. When in the past whole species or ecosystems were destroyed, no one realized or even cared. Alongside all the other improvements, our surveillance of suffering has improved tremendously. This improved reporting is itself a sign of human progress, but it creates the impression of the exact opposite. At the same time, activists and lobbyists skillfully manage to make every dip in a trend appear to be the end of the world, even if the general trend is clearly improving. scaring us with alarmist exaggerations and prophecies. For example, in the United States, the violent crime rate has been on a downward trend since 1990. Just under 14.5 million crimes were reported in 1990. By 2016, that number was well under 9.5 million. Each time something horrific or shocking happened, which was pretty much every year, a crisis was reported. The majority of people, the vast majority of the time, believe that violent crime is getting worse. No wonder we get an illusion of constant deterioration. The news constantly alerts us to bad events in the present. The doom-laden feeling that this creates in us is then intensified by our inability to remember the past. Our historical knowledge is rosy and pink, and we fail to remember that 1 year ago, or 10 years ago, or 50 years ago, there was the same number of terrible events, probably more. This illusion of deterioration creates great stress for some people and makes other people lose hope. For no good reason. Feeling. Not thinking. There's something else going on as well. What are people really thinking when they say the world is getting worse? My guess is they are not thinking. They are feeling. If you still feel uncomfortable agreeing that the world is getting better, even after I have shown you all this beautiful data, my guess is that it's because you know that huge problems still remain. My guess is you feel that me saying the world is getting better is like me telling you that everything is fine, or that you should look away from these problems and pretend they don't exist. And that feels ridiculous and stressful. I agree. Everything is not fine. We should still be very concerned. As long as there are plane crashes, preventable child deaths, endangered species, climate change deniers, male chauvinists, crazy dictators, toxic waste, journalists in prison, and girls not getting an education because of their gender, as long as any such terrible things exist, we cannot relax. But it is just as ridiculous and just as stressful to look away from the progress that has been made. People often call me an optimist because I show them the enormous progress they didn't know about. That makes me angry. I'm not an optimist. That makes me sound naive. I'm a very serious possibilist. That's something I made up. It means that someone who neither hopes without reason nor fears without reason, someone who constantly resists the over-dramatic worldview. As a possibilist, I see all this progress, and it fills me with conviction and hope that further progress is possible. This is not optimistic. It is having a clear and reasonable idea about how things are. It is having a worldview that is constructive and useful. When people wrongly believe that nothing is improving, they may conclude that nothing we have tried so far is working and lose confidence in measures that actually work. I meet many such people who tell me they have lost all hope for humanity. Or they may have become radicals supporting drastic measures that are counterproductive when in fact the methods we are already using to improve our world are working just fine. Take, for example, girls' education. Educating girls has proven to be one of the world's best ever ideas. When women are educated, all kinds of wonderful things happen in societies. The workforce becomes diversified and able to make better decisions and solve more problems. Educated mothers decide to have fewer children and more children survive. More energy and time is invested in each child's education. It's a virtuous cycle of change. Poor parents who can't afford to send all their children to school have often prioritized the boys. But since 1970, there has been fantastic progress. Across religions, cultures, and continents, almost all parents can now afford to send all their children to school and are sending their daughters as well as their sons. Now the girls have almost caught up. 90% of girls of primary school age attend school. For boys, the figure is 92%. That's almost no difference. There are still gender differences when it comes to education on level one, especially when it comes to secondary and higher education. But that's no reason to deny the progress that has been made. I see no conflict between celebrating this progress and continuing to fight for more. I am a possibilist. And the progress we have made tells me it's possible to get all girls in school and all boys, too, and that we should work hard to make that happen. It won't happen by itself, and if we lose hope because of stupid misconceptions, it might not happen at all. The loss of hope is probably the most devastating consequence of the negativity instinct and the ignorance it causes. How to control the negativity instinct? How can we help our brains to realize that things are getting better when everything is screaming at us that things are getting worse? Bad and better. The solution is not to balance out all the negative news with more positive news. That would just risk creating a self-deceiving, comforting, misleading bias in the other direction. It would be as helpful as balancing too much sugar with too much salt. It would make things more exciting, but maybe even less healthy. A solution that works for me is to persuade myself to keep two thoughts in my head at the same time. It seems that when we hear someone say things are getting better, we think they are saying, "Don't worry, relax," or even, "Look away." But when I say things are getting better, I am not saying those things at all. I am certainly not advocating looking away from the terrible problems in the world. I am saying that things can be both bad and better. Think of the world as a premature baby in an incubator. The baby's health status is extremely bad, and her breathing, heart rate, and other important signs are tracked constantly, so that changes for better or worse can quickly be seen. After a week, she is getting a lot better. On all the main measures, she is improving. But she still has to stay in the incubator because her health is still critical. Does it make sense to say that the infant situation is improving? Yes, absolutely. Does it make sense to say it is bad? Yes, absolutely. Does saying things are improving imply that everything is fine and that we should all relax and not worry? No, not at all. It is helpful to have to choose between bad and improving? Definitely not. It's both. It's both bad and better. Better and bad at the same time. That is how we must think about the current state of the world. Expect bad news. Something else that helps to control the negativity instinct is to constantly expect bad news. Remember that the media and activists rely on drama to grab your attention. Remember that negative stories are more dramatic than neutral or positive ones. Remember how simple it is to construct a story of crisis from a temporary dip pulled out of its context of a long-term improvement. Remember that we live in a connected and transparent world where reporting about suffering is better than it has ever been before. When you hear about something terrible, calm yourself by asking, if there had been an equally large positive improvement, would I have heard about that? Even if there had been hundreds of larger improvements, would I have heard? Would I ever hear about children who don't drown? Can I see a decrease in child drownings or in deaths from tuberculosis out my window or on the news or in a charity's publicity material? Keep in mind that the positive changes may be more common, but they don't find you. You need to find them. And if you look in the statistics, they are everywhere. This reminder will give you the basic protection to allow you and your children to keep watching the news without being carried away into dystopia on a daily basis. Don't censor history. When we hang on to a rose-tinted version of history, we deprive ourselves and our children of the truth. The evidence about the terrible past is scary, but it is a great resource. It can help us to appreciate what we have today and provide us with hope that future generations will, as previous generations did, get over the dips and continue the long-term trends towards peace, prosperity, and solutions to our global problems. I would like to thank society. Struggling for breath in that ditch full of pee 65 years ago in a working-class suburb in Sweden, little did I know that I would be the first in my family to go to university. Little did I know that I would become a global health professor and travel to Davos and tell the world's experts that they knew less about basic global trends than chimpanzees. I didn't know any basic global trends myself back then, of course. I had to learn them. The only way anyone can know about different causes of death and how they are changing, for example, is to keep track of every death and its cause, write them down, and then add them up. That's extremely time-consuming. There's only one such data set in the whole world. It's named the Global Burden of Disease. And when I consulted it many years later, it showed me that my near-death experience was not so special. It was a common type of accident for a child under 5 living on level 3. All I knew was that I was stuck. My grandmother came to the rescue and lifted me up. And then Swedish society lifted me further. During my lifetime, Sweden moved from level 3 to level 4. A treatment against tuberculosis was invented, and my mother got well. She read books to me that she borrowed from the public library for free. I became the first in my family to get more than 6 years of education, and I went to university for free. I got a doctor's degree for free. Of course, nothing is free. The taxpayers paid. And then at the age of 30, when I had become a father of 2 and I discovered my first cancer, I was treated and cured by the world's best healthcare system. For free. My survival and success in life has always depended on others. Thanks to my family, free education, and free healthcare, I made it all the way from that ditch to the World Economic Forum. I would never have made it on my own. Today, now that Sweden is on level 4, only 3 children in 1,000 die before the age of 5. And only 1% of those deaths are drownings. Fences, daycare, life jacket campaigns, swimming lessons, and lifeguards at public pools all cost money. Child death from drowning is one of the many horrors that has nearly disappeared as the country has become richer. That is what I call progress. The same improvements are taking place across the world today. Most countries are currently improving faster than Sweden ever did. Much faster. Factfulness. Factfulness is recognizing when we get negative news and remembering that information about bad events is much more likely to reach us. When things are getting better, we often don't hear about them. This gives us a systematically too negative impression of the world around us, which is very stressful. To control the negativity instinct, expect bad news. Better and bad. Practice distinguishing between a level, for instance, bad, and a direction of change, for instance, better. Convince yourself that things can be both better and bad. Good news is not news. Good news is almost never reported, so news is almost always bad. When you see bad news, ask whether equally positive news would have reached you. Gradual improvement is not news. When a trend is gradually improving with periodic dips, you're more likely to notice the dips than the overall improvement. More news does not equal more suffering. More bad news is sometimes due to better surveillance of suffering, not a worsening world. Beware of rosy pasts. People often glorify their early experiences, and nations often glorify their histories. Chapter 3. The Straight Line Instinct. How more survivors means fewer people, how traffic accidents are like cavities, and why my grandson is like the population of the world. The most frightening graph I ever saw. Statistics can be terrifying. On September 23rd, 2014, I was sitting at my desk in the Gapminder office in Stockholm when I saw a line on a graph that gripped me with fear. I had been concerned about the Ebola outbreak in West Africa since August. Like others, I had seen the tragic images in the media of people dying in the streets of Monrovia, the capital of Liberia. But in my work, I often heard about sudden outbreaks of deadly diseases, and I had assumed it was just like most others, and would soon be contained. The graph in the World Health Organization research article shocked me into fear and then action. The researchers had collected all the Ebola data since the start of the epidemic and used it to calculate the expected number of new cases per day up to the end of October. They showed, for the first time, that the number of cases was not just increasing along a straight line, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Instead, the line was doubling like this, 1, 2, 4, 8, 16. Each infected person was infecting, on average, two more people before dying. As a result, the number of new cases per day was doubling every 3 weeks. The graph showed how enormous the outbreak would soon become if each infected person kept infecting two more. Doubling is scary. I had first learned about the effect of doubling at school. In the Indian legend, the Lord Krishna asks for one grain of rice in the first square of the chessboard, then 2 grains, on the second square. 4 grains on the third square, then 8 and so on, doubling the number of grains each time. By the time he gets to the last of the 64 squares, he is owed 18 quintillion, 446 quadrillion, 744 trillion, 73 billion, 709 million, 551,615 grains of rice. Enough to cover the whole of India with a layer of rice 30 inches deep. Anything that keeps doubling grows much faster than we first assume. So I knew the situation in West Africa was about to become desperate. Liberia was at risk of a catastrophe worse than its recently ended civil war, and one that would almost inevitably spread to the entire world. Unlike malaria, Ebola could spread quickly in all climates and could travel on airplanes, across borders and oceans, inside the bodies of unknowingly infected passengers. There was no effective treatment for it. People were already dying in the streets now, within only 9 weeks, the time needed for 3 doublings. The situation would be 8 times as desperate. Every 3-week delay in dealing with the problem would mean twice as many people infected and twice as many resources needed. Ebola had to be stopped within weeks. At Gapminder, we immediately changed our priorities and started studying the data and producing information videos to explain the urgency of the situation. By October 20th, I had canceled all my assignments for the next 3 months and was on a plane to Liberia, where I hoped my 20 years of studying epidemics in rural sub-Saharan Africa could be of some use. I remained in Liberia for 3 months, missing Christmas and New Year's with my family for the first time ever. Like the rest of the world, I was too slow to understand the magnitude and urgency of the Ebola crisis. I had assumed that the increase in cases was a straight line, when in fact the data clearly showed that it was a doubling line. Once I understood this, I acted. But I wish I had understood and acted sooner. The mega misconception that the world population is just increasing and increasing. Nowadays, the word sustainability is found in the title of almost every conference I get invited to. One of the most important numbers of the sustainability equation is the human population. There must be some kind of limit to how many people can live on this planet, right? So when I started testing my audiences at these sustainability conferences, I just assumed that they would know the basic facts about global population growth. Seldom have I been so wrong. We have now arrived at the third instinct, the straight line instinct, and the third and last mega misconception. The false idea that the world population is just increasing. Please pay attention to the word just. This word is the misconception. In fact, the world population is increasing very fast. Roughly 1 billion people will be added over the next 13 years. That's true. That's not a misconception. But it's not just increasing. The word just implies that if nothing is done, the population will just keep on growing. It implies that some drastic action is needed in order to stop the growth. That is the misconception. And I think it is based on the same instinct that stopped me and the world from acting sooner to stop Ebola. The instinct to assume that lines are straight. I rarely get speechless, but it happened the first time I asked an audience the following question. It was at a teachers' conference in Norway. But I don't mean to be too hard on the Norwegians. It might just as well have been in Finland, too. Many of these teachers were teaching global population trends as part of their social science classes. When I turned my head around and saw the results from the live poll on the screen behind me, I couldn't find words. I remember thinking that there must be something wrong with the polling devices. Fact question 5. There are 2 billion children in the world today, aged 0 to 15 years old. How many children will there be in the year 2100, according to the UN? A. 4 billion. B. 3 billion. C. 2 billion. Again, chimpanzees pick the correct line 33% of the time. The teachers in Norway, only 9%. I was shocked. How could such an important group of people score worse than random? What were they teaching the children? I kind of hoped the polling devices were broken, but they were not. We got the same terrible results in our public polls in the United States, the United Kingdom, Sweden, Germany, France, and Australia. 85% of people picked the wrong ones. The experts at the World Economic Forum, they answered much better than the public, almost as well as chimpanzees. 26% got it right. Thinking it over more calmly after the teachers' conference was over, I started to see the size of the knowledge problem. The number of future children is the most essential number for making global population forecasts. So it is central to the whole sustainability debate. If we get this number wrong, we are going to get a lot else wrong. Yet almost none of the highly educated and influential people we have measured have the slightest knowledge of what the population experts are all agreeing about. The numbers are freely available online from the UN website, but free access to data doesn't turn into knowledge without effort. The UN line is alternative C. UN experts expect that in the year 2100, there will be 2 billion children, the same number as today. They don't expect the line to continue straight. They expect no further increase. I'll soon get back to this. The straight line instinct. Take a graph that shows the world population since the year 8000 BC. That's when agriculture was invented. Back then, the total human population was roughly 5 million people, spread along coastlines and rivers all over the world. The total of humanity was smaller than the population of one of our big cities today, London, Bangkok, or Rio de Janeiro. This number increased only slowly for almost 10,000 years, eventually reaching 1 billion in the year 1800. Then something happened. The next billion were added in only 130 years, and another 5 billion were added in under 100 years. Of course, people get worried when they see such a steep increase and they know the planet has limited resources. It sure looks like it's just increasing, and at a very high speed. When looking at a stone flying toward you, you can often predict whether it's going to hit you. You need no numbers, no graphs, no spreadsheets. Your eyes and brain extend the trajectory, and you move out of the stone's way. It's easy to imagine how this automatic visual forecasting skill helped our ancestors survive, and it still helps us survive. When driving a car, we constantly predict where other cars will be within the next few seconds. But our straight-line intuition is not always a reliable guide in modern life. When looking at a line graph, for example, it's nearly impossible not to imagine a straight line that stretches beyond the end of the trend, into the future. Let me now give you another example that I know you are more familiar with. My youngest grandchild, Mino, was 19.5 inches long when he was born. In his first 6 months, he grew to 26.5 inches, an impressive growth of 7 inches. Impressive, but also scary. Imagine his growth chart into the future. It's terrifying. If Mino just continues growing, he will be 60 inches tall on his third birthday, a 5-foot toddler. By his 10th birthday, he will be 160 inches tall, over 13 feet. And then what? This can't just continue. Somebody must do something drastic. Mino's parents will have to remodel their house or find some medication. The straight-line intuition is obviously wrong in this case. Why is it obvious? Because we all have first-hand experience of a growing body. We know Mino's growth curve won't just continue. We've never met a person 160 inches tall. Assuming the trend will continue along a straight line is obviously ludicrous. But when we're less familiar with a topic, it's surprisingly difficult to imagine how stupid such an assumption may be. The UN population experts have first-hand experience of calculating population sizes. It's their job. The world population today is 7.6 billion people. And yes, it's growing fast. Still, the growth has already started to slow down. And the UN experts are pretty sure it will keep slowing down over the next few decades. They think the curve will flatten out at somewhere between 10 and 12 billion people by the end of the century. The shape of the population curve. To understand the shape of this population curve, we need to understand where the increase in population is coming from. Why is the population increasing? Fact question 6. The UN predicts that by 2100, the world population will have increased by another 4 billion people. What is the main reason? A. There will be more children, age below 15. B. There will be more adults, age 15 to 74. C. There will be more very old people, age 75 and older. This one I'll give you the answer right away. The correct answer is B. The experts are convinced the population will keep growing mainly because there will be more adults, not more children and not more very old people. More adults. The number of children is not expected to increase, which we know already from this chapter's first fact question. But the UN experts are not predicting that the number of children will stop increasing. They are reporting that it is already happening. The radical change that is needed to stop rapid population growth is that the number of children stops growing, and that is already happening. How could that be? That everybody should know. When I was born in 1948, women on average gave birth to 5 children each. After 1965, the number started dropping like it never had done before. Over the last 50 years, it dropped all the way to the amazingly low world average of just below 2.5. This dramatic change happened in parallel with all those other improvements I described in the last chapter. As billions of people left extreme poverty, most of them decided to have fewer children. They no longer needed large families for child labor on the small family farm, and they no longer needed extra children as insurance against child mortality. Women and men got educated and started to want better educated and better fed children. And having fewer of them was the obvious solution. In practice, that goal was easier to realize thanks to the wonderful blessing of modern contraceptives, which let parents have fewer children without having less sex. The dramatic drop in babies per woman is expected to continue as long as more people keep escaping extreme poverty and more women get educated, and as access to contraceptives and sexual education keeps increasing. Nothing drastic is needed, just more of what we are already doing. The exact speed of the future drop is not possible to predict exactly. It depends on how fast these changes continue to happen. But in any case, the annual number of births in the world has already stopped increasing, which means that the period of fast population growth will soon be over. We are now arriving at peak child. But then if the number of births has already stopped increasing, where are the 4 billion new adults going to come from? Spaceships? Why will the population stop increasing? In 2030, there will be 2 billion new 0 to 15-year-olds. Everyone else will have grown older. The 0 to 15-year-olds of today will have become 15 to 30-year-olds. The 15 to 30-year-olds of today will have become 2 billion 30 to 45-year-olds. There are only 1 billion 30 to 45-year-olds today. So without any increase in the number of children being born, and without people living for longer, there will be 1 billion more adults. The 1 billion new adults come not from new children, but from children and young adults who have already been born. For three generations, this pattern will repeat itself. In 2045, the 2 billion 30 to 45-year-olds will become 45 to 60-year-olds, and we will have another 1 billion adults. In 2060, the 2 billion 45 to 60-year-olds will become 60 to 75-year-olds, and we will have another 1 billion adults. But look what happens next. From 2060, each generation of 2 billion people will be replaced by another generation of 2 billion people. The fast growth stops. The large increase in population is going to happen not because there are more children, and not in the main because old folks are living longer. In fact, the UN experts do predict that by 2100, world life expectancy will have increased by roughly 11 years, adding 1 billion old people to the total, and taking it to around 11 billion. The large increase in population will happen mainly because the children who already exist today are going to grow up and fill up the diagram with 3 billion more adults. This fill-up effect takes three generations, and then it is done. That's actually all you need to know to understand the method that the UN experts use to not just draw a straight line into the future. This explanation is a brutal simplification. Many die before they reach 75, and many parents have their children after they reach 30. But even including these facts makes no difference to the big picture. In balance with nature. When a population is not growing over a long period of time and the population curve is flat, this must mean that each generation of new parents is the same size as the previous one. For thousands of years, up to 1800, the population curve was almost flat. Have you heard people say that humans used to live in balance with nature? Well, yes, there was a balance. But let's avoid the rose-tinted glasses. Until 1800, women gave birth to 6 children on average, so the population should have increased with each generation. Instead, it stayed more or less stable. Remember the child skeletons in the graveyards of the past? On average, 4 out of 6 children died before becoming parents themselves, leaving just 2 surviving children to parent the next generation. There was a balance. It wasn't because humans lived in balance with nature. Humans died in balance with nature. It was utterly brutal and tragic. Today, humanity is once again reaching a balance. The number of parents is no longer increasing. But this balance is dramatically different from the old balance. The new balance is nice. The typical parents have 2 children and neither of them dies. For the first time in human history, we live in balance. The population grew from 3 billion in 1900 to 7 billion in 2000 because humanity went through a transition from one balance to another during the 20th century. A unique period of human history when 2 parents on average produce more than 2 children who survived to become parents themselves in the next generation. That period of imbalance is the reason why today the 2 youngest generations are larger than the others. That period of imbalance is the reason behind the fill-up. But the new balance is already achieved. The annual number of births is no longer increasing. If extreme poverty keeps falling and sex education and contraception keep spreading, then the world population will keep growing fast, but only until the inevitable fill-up is completed. Wait, they still have many children. Even after I show these charts on stage, people come up to me after the presentation and tell me that the charts can't be correct because, you know, people in Africa and Latin America still have many children, and religious people refuse contraceptives and still have huge families. Skilled journalists pick and choose dramatic, exceptional people in their reports. In the mass media, we sometimes see examples of very religious people, whether living in traditional ways or leading seemingly modern lives, who proudly show us their very large families as evidence of faith. Such documentary films, TV shows, and media reports give the impression that religion leads to much larger families. But whatever their religion, whether they are Catholics, Jews, or Muslims, these families share one quality. They are the exceptions. In reality, the connection between religion and babies per woman is not so impressive. Throughout this book, I discuss how the media chooses its exceptional stories, and in Chapter 7, I will debunk the myth of religion and large families. For now, let's look at the single factor that does have a strong connection with large families. Extreme poverty. Why more survivors lead to fewer people? When combining all the parents living on levels 2, 3, and 4 from every region of the world, and of every religion or no religion, together they have, on average, 2 children. No kidding. This includes the populations of Iran, Mexico, India, Tunisia, Bangladesh, Brazil, Turkey, Indonesia, and Sri Lanka, just to name a few examples. The poorest 10% combined still have 5 children on average, And on average, every second family living in extreme poverty loses one of their children before he or she reaches the age of 5. That is shamefully high, but still far better than the ghastly numbers that have kept population growth down in the bad old times. When people hear that the population is growing, they intuitively think it will continue to grow unless something is done. They intuitively visualize the trend continuing into the future. But remember, for my grandchild Mino to stop growing taller, nothing drastic needs to be done. Melinda Gates runs a philanthropic foundation together with her husband Bill. They have spent billions of dollars to save the lives of millions of children in extreme poverty by investing in primary health care and education. Yet intelligent and well-meaning people keep contacting their foundation saying that they should stop. The argument goes like this. If you keep saving poor children, you'll kill the planet by causing overpopulation. I have also heard this argument after some of my presentations from people who may have the best intentions and want to save the planet for future generations. It sounds intuitively correct. If more children survive, the population just increases, right? No. Completely wrong. Parents in extreme poverty need many children for the reasons I set out earlier, for child labor, but also to have extra children in case some children die. It is the countries with the highest child mortality rates, like Somalia, Chad, Mali, and Niger, where women have the most babies, between 5 and 8. Once parents see children survive, once the children are no longer needed for child labor, and once the women are educated and have information about and access to contraceptives across cultures and religions, both the men and the women instead start dreaming of having fewer, well-educated children. Saving poor children just increases the population. Sounds correct. But the opposite is true. Delaying the escape from extreme poverty just increases the population. Every generation kept in extreme poverty will produce an even larger next generation. The only proven method for curbing population growth is to eradicate extreme poverty and give people better lives, including education and contraceptives. Across the world, parents then have chosen for themselves to have fewer children. This transformation has happened across the world because it has never happened without lowering child mortality. This discussion so far has left out the most important point, which is the moral imperative to help people escape from the misery and indignity of extreme poverty. The argument that we must save the planet for future people not yet born is difficult for me to hear when people are suffering today. But when it comes to child mortality, we don't have to choose between the present and the future, or between our hearts and our heads. They all point in the same direction. We should do everything we can to reduce child mortality, not only as an act of humanity for living, suffering children, but to benefit the whole world now and in the future. Two public health miracles. In the first full year of Bangladesh's independence, 1972, Bangladeshi women had on average 7 children, and life expectancy was 52. Today, Bangladeshi women have 2 children, and a newborn can expect to live 73 years. In 4 decades, Bangladesh has gone from miserable to decent, from level 1 to level 2. It is a miracle, delivered through remarkable progress in basic health and child survival. The child survival rate is now 97%, up from less than 80% at independence. Now that parents have reason to expect that all their children will survive, a major reason for having big families is gone. In Egypt in 1960, 30% of all children in the land around the Nile died before their fifth birthday. The Nile Delta was a misery for children, with all sorts of dangerous diseases and malnutrition. Then, a miracle happened. The Egyptians built the Aswan Dam. They wired electricity into people's homes, improved education, built up primary health care, eradicated malaria, and made drinking water safer. Today, Egypt's child mortality rate, at 2.3%, is lower than it was in France or the United Kingdom in 1960. How to control the straight line instinct, or not all lines are straight? The best way of controlling the instinct to always see straight lines, whether in relation to population growth or in other situations, is simply to remember that curves naturally come in lots of different shapes. Many aspects of the world are best represented by curves shaped like an S, or a slide, or a hump, and not by a straight line. Here are some examples, each showing how a particular aspect of life changes as we move across the four income levels. Straight lines. Straight lines are much less common than we tend to think, but some lines are straight. The data show that money and health go hand in hand. We don't know from just looking at the line which comes first or what the relationship is between the two. It might be that a healthy population produces more income. It might be that a rich population can afford better health. I think both are true. What we do know from such a line is that in general, where income is higher, health is better. We can also find straight lines when we compare income levels with education, marriage, age, and spending on recreation. More income goes hand in hand with longer average schooling, with women marrying later, and with a greater share of income going toward recreation. S-bends. When we compare income with basic necessities like primary-level education or vaccination, we see S-shaped curves. They are low and flat at level 1. Then they rise quickly through level 2, because above level 1, countries can afford primary education and vaccination, the most cost-effective health intervention there is, for just about the entire population. Just as we will buy ourselves a fridge and a cell phone as soon as we can afford them, countries will invest in primary education and vaccination as soon as they can afford them. Then the curves flatten off at levels 3 and 4. Everyone already has these things. The curves reach their maximum and stay there. Remembering about this kind of curve will help you to improve your guessing about the world. On level 2, almost everyone can already afford to have their basic physical needs met. Slides. The babies per woman curve looks like a slide in a playground. It starts flat, then after a certain level of income, it slopes downward, and then it flattens out and stays quite low, just below 2 babies per woman. Shifting away from income graphs for a moment, we see a similar shape for the cost of vaccinations. In basic math classes, we teach children to multiply. If an injection costs $10, what's the price of 1,000,000 injections? UNICEF knows how to count, but it has also saved millions of children's lives by not accepting a straight line. It has negotiated huge contracts with pharmaceutical companies in which the price is cut to the bare minimum in return for guaranteed long contracts. But when you have negotiated to the bottom price, you can't get lower. That's another slide-shaped curve. Humps. Your tomato plant will grow as long as it gets water. So if more water is what it needs, why don't you turn the hose on it so you can grow an enormous prize-winning tomato?